started chasing one another, falling down and acting silly. She laughed as loudly as the other kids. She looked constantly to her mom and dad to see if they were watching. She tugged on their sleeves, but they just nodded and continued to talk, eat, and drink. When another family sat close, and a boy older than her laughed at the jugglers as well, Juliet felt suddenly like she had company. She began to squeal even louder. The jugglers were the brightest things she had ever seen. She could have watched them forever. But then the lights were dimmed, and the play began. And it was boring by comparison. It started off well with a rousing sword fight, but then it was a lot of strange words, and a man and a woman looking at each other, the way her parents did, talking in some funny language. Juliet fell asleep. She dreamed of flying through the silo with 100 colorful balls and hoops soaring all around her, always out of reach, the hoops round like the numbers at the end of the bazaar's level. And then she woke up to whistles and applause. Her parents were standing and yelling while the people on the stage in the funny costumes took several bows. Juliet yawned and looked over at the boy on the bench beside her. He was sleeping with his mouth open, his head in his mom's lap, his shoulders shaking while she clapped and clapped. They gathered up the sheet, and her father carried her down to the stage, where the sword fighters and strange talkers were speaking to the audience and shaking hands. Juliet wanted to meet the jugglers. She wanted to learn how to make the hoops float in the air. But her parents waited instead until they could speak to one of the ladies, the one who had her hair braided and twisted into drooping curves. "Juliet," her father told her, lifting her onto the stage, "I want you to meet Juliet." He gestured to the woman in the fluffy dress with the strange hair. "Is that your real name?" the lady asked, kneeling down and reaching for Juliet's hand. Juliet pulled it back like it was another rabbit about to bite her, but nodded. "You were wonderful," her mom told the lady. They shook hands and introduced themselves. "Did you like the play?" the lady with the funny hair asked. Juliet nodded. She could sense that she was supposed to, and that this made it okay to lie. "Her father and I came to the show years ago when we first started dating," her mother said. She rubbed Juliet's hair. "We were going to name our first child either Romeus or Juliet." "Well, be glad you had a girl then," the lady said, smiling. Her parents laughed, and Juliet was beginning to be less afraid of this woman with the same name as her. "Do you think we could get your autograph?" Her father let go of her shoulder and rummaged in his pack. "I have a program in here somewhere." "Why not a script for this young Juliet?" the lady smiled at her. "Are you learning your letters?" "I can count to 100, Juliet said proudly. The woman paused, then smiled. Juliet watched her as she stood and crossed the stage, her dress flowing in a way that overalls never could. The lady returned from behind a curtain with a tiny book of papers held fast with brass pins. She accepted a charcoal from Juliet's father and wrote her name large and curly across the cover. The woman pressed the collection of papers into her small hands. "I want you to have this, Juliet of the Silo," her mother protested. "Oh, we couldn't. That's too much paper."
"She's only 5, her father said.
"I have another," the lady assured them. "We make our own. I want her to have it." She reached out and touched Juliet's cheek, and this time Juliet didn't pull away. She was too busy flipping through the papers, looking at all the curly notes handwritten along the sides beside the printed words. One word she noticed was circled over and over among all the others. She couldn't make out many of them, but this one she could read. It was her name. It was at the beginning of so many sentences. Juliet. This was her. She looked up at the lady, understanding at once why her parents had brought her there, why they'd walked so far and for so long. "Thank you," she said, remembering her manners. And then, after some consideration, "I'm sorry I fell asleep." 32. A glooming peace this morning with it brings. The sun for sorrow will not show his head. Go hence to have more talk of these sad things. Some shall be pardoned and some punished. It was the morning of the worst cleaning of Lucas's life, and for once he considered going into work, ignoring the paid holiday, to pretend it was a day like any other. He sat at the foot of his bed as he worked up the courage to move, one of his many star charts in his lap. Lightly with his fingers, so as not to smear the marks away, he caressed the charcoal outline of one star in particular. It wasn't a star like the others. Those were simple dots on a meticulous grid with details of date cited, location, and intensity. This wasn't that kind of star, not one that lasted nearly so long. It was the five-pointed kind, the outline of a sheriff's badge. He remembered drawing the shape while she was talking to him one night, the steel on her chest glowing faintly as it caught the weak light from the stairwell. He remembered her voice being magical, the way she carried herself mesmerizing, and her arrival into his boring routine had been as unexpected as the parting of clouds. He also remembered how she had turned away from him in her cell two nights ago, had tried to save his feelings by pushing him away. Lucas had no more tears. He had spent most of the night shedding them for this woman he hardly knew. And now he wondered what he would do with his day, with his life. The thought of her out there, doing anything for them, cleaning, made him sick. He wondered if that was why he'd had no appetite for 2 days. Some deep part of his gut must have known he'd never keep anything down, even if he forced himself to eat. He set the star chart aside and dropped his face into his palms. He rested there, so tired, trying to convince himself to just get up and go to work. If he went to work, at least he'd be distracted. He tried to remember where he'd left off in the server room last week. Was it the number 8 tower that had gone down again? Sammy had suggested he swap out the control board, but Lucas had suspected a bad cable. That's what he'd been doing, he remembered now, toning out the Ethernet runs. It's what he should have been doing right then, that very day. Anything but sitting around on a holiday, feeling like he could be physically ill over a woman about whom he'd done little more than tell his mother. Lucas stood and shrugged on the same pair of overalls he'd worn the day before. He remained there a moment, staring at his bare feet, wondering why he'd gotten up. Where was he going? His mind was completely blank, his body numb. He wondered if he could stand there, unmoving, his stomach twisted in knots, for the rest of his life. Someone would eventually find him, wouldn't they? Dead and stiff, standing upright, a statue of a corpse. He shook his head and these black thoughts loose, and looked for his boots. He found them. It was an accomplishment. Lucas had done something by getting himself dressed. He left his room and ambled toward the landing, weaving around kids squealing from another day off school, parents trying to corral them and get their boots and overalls on. The commotion was little more than background noise for Lucas. It was a hum, like the aches in his legs from the long climb down to see her, and the even longer climb back up. He stepped out onto the apartment's landing and felt a habitual tug upward toward the cafeteria. All he could think about was all he had thought of for the past week, making it through another day so he could go up top for the chance to see her. It suddenly occurred to Lucas that he still could. He wasn't one for sunrises, he much preferred the twilight and the stars, but if he wanted to see her, all he had to do was climb to the cafeteria and scan the landscape. There would be a new body there, a new suit with the shine still on it glimmering and whatever weak rays the sun dribbled through those blasted clouds. He could see the image clearly in his head, her uncomfortable sprawl, legs twisted, arm pinned, helmet turned to the side, gazing back at the silo. Sadder still, he saw himself decades later, a lonely old man sitting in front of that gray wall screen and drawing not star charts, but landscapes. The same landscapes over and over, looking up at a wasting might-have-been, sketching that same still pose while weeping tears that dripped and turned charcoal to mud. He would be like Marnes, that poor man. And thinking of the deputy, who died with no one to bury him, it reminded Lucas of the last thing Juliet had told him. She had begged him to find someone, to not be like her, to never be alone. He gripped Landing 50's cool steel railing and leaned over. Looking down, he could watch the stairwell drill its way deep into the earth. The landing for 56 was visible below, the several landings between jutting off at unseen angles. It was hard to gauge the distance, but he figured it was more than enough. No need to walk down to 82, which most jumpers preferred for its long clear path down to 99. Suddenly, he saw himself in flight, tumbling down, arms and legs splayed. He reckoned he would just miss the landing. One of the railings would catch him and saw him near in half. Or maybe if he jumped out a little further, maybe if he aimed his head, he could make it quick. He straightened, feeling a twinge of fear and a rush of adrenaline from picturing the fall, the end, so vividly. He glanced around and checked the morning traffic to see if anyone was watching him. He had seen other adults peer over railings before. He'd always assumed bad thoughts were going through their heads, because he knew, growing up in the silo, that only children dropped physical things from the landings. By the time you got older, you knew to keep a grip on all that you could. Eventually it was something else that slipped away, something else you lost that tumbled down through the heart of the silo, that made you ponder leaping after. The landing shivered with the beat of a hurrying porter. The sound of bare feet slapping against steel treads came next and spiraled closer. Lucas slid away from the railing and tried to focus on what he was doing that day. Maybe he should just crawl back into bed and sleep, kill some hours with unconsciousness. As he attempted to summon some sliver of motivation, the speeding porter flew past, and Lucas caught a glimpse of the boy's face twisted in consternation. Even as he sped out of sight, his pace swift and reckless, the image of his worry remained vividly lodged in Lucas's mind. And Lucas knew. As the rapid patter of the boy's feet wound deeper into the earth, he knew something had happened that morning. Something up top, something newsworthy about the cleaning. A seed of hope, some wishful kernel buried deep, where he was loath to acknowledge it, lest it poison or choke him, began to sprout. Maybe the cleaning never happened. Was it possible her banishment had been reconsidered? The people of Mechanical had sent up a petition. Hundreds of daring signatures, risking their own necks to save hers. Had the mad gesture from the down deep worn the judges down? That tiny seed of hope sprang roots. It grew vine-like through Lucas's chest, filling him with an urgency to run up and see for himself. He left the railing, and the dream of leaping after his worries, and pushed his way through the morning crowd. Whispers, he noticed, were already forming in the porter's wake. He wasn't the only one who had noticed. As he joined the upbound traffic, he realized the aches in his legs from the days before had vanished. He prepared to pass the slow-moving family in front of him, when he heard the loud squawk of a radio behind him. Lucas turned to find Deputy Marsh, a few treads back, fumbling for the radio on his hip, a small cardboard box clutched to his chest, a sheen of sweat on his forehead. Lucas stopped and held the railing, waiting for the MIDS deputy to reach him.
Marsh!
The deputy finally got the volume down on his radio and glanced up. He nodded to Lucas. The both of them squeezed against the railing as a worker and his shadow passed them, heading upward.
What's the news? Lucas asked.
He knew the deputy well, and he knew he might spill it for free. Marsh swiped his forehead and moved the box into the crook of his other arm.
That Bernard is whooping my ass this morning, he complained. Done climbed enough this week.
No, what of the cleaning? Lucas asked. A porter just hurried by like he'd seen a ghost.
Deputy Marsh glanced up the steps.
I was told to bring her things to 34 as quick as grease. Hank nearly killed himself bringing them partway up to me.
He started up the stairs as if he couldn't afford to stay.
Look, I've got to keep moving if I want to keep my job.
Lucas held his arm, and traffic swelled below them as annoyed climbers squeezed past and against the occasional travelers heading down.
Did the cleaning go through or not? Lucas demanded.
Marsh sagged against the railing. Quiet chatter popped through his radio.
No,
he whispered, and Lucas felt as though he could fly. He could fly straight up the space between the stairs and the concrete heart of the silo, could soar around the landings, could go 50 levels at a leap.
She went out, but she didn't clean, Marsh said,
his voice low but laced with words sharp enough to pierce Lucas's dreams.
She wandered over them hills.
Wait, what?
Marsh nodded, and sweat dripped from the deputy's nose.
Plumb out of sight, he hissed,
like a radio turned down low.
Now I've got to get her things up to Bernard.
I'll do it,
Lucas said, reaching out his hands.
I'm going to 34 anyway.
Marsh shifted the box. The poor deputy seemed liable to collapse at any moment. Lucas begged him, just as he had 2 days earlier, in order to see Juliet in her cell.
Let me take them up for you, he said. You know Bernard won't mind. He and I are good friends, just like you and I have always been.
Deputy Marsh wiped his lip and nodded ever so slightly, thinking on this.
Look, I'm going up anyway, Lucas said.
He found himself slowly taking the box from an exhausted Marsh, even though the waves of emotion surging through his own body made it difficult to focus. The traffic on the stairs had become background noise. The idea that Juliet might still be in the silo had slipped away, but the news that she hadn't cleaned, that she had made it over the hills, this filled him with something else. It touched the part of him that yearned to map the stars. It meant no one would ever have to watch her waste away.
You'll be careful with that, Marsh said.
His eyes were on the box, now tucked into Lucas's arms.
I'll guard it with my life, Lucas told him. Trust me.
Marsh nodded to let him know he did. And Lucas hurried up the stairs, ahead of those rising to celebrate the cleaning.
the weight of Juliet's belongings rattling softly in a box tucked tightly against his chest. 33. Thy old groans ring yet in my ancient ears. Walker the electrician bent over a cluttered workbench and adjusted his magnifier. The great bulbous lens was attached to his head with a hoop that might have been uncomfortable had he not been wearing it for most of his 62 years. As he pushed the glass into position, the small black chip on the green electronics board came into crystal focus. He could see each of the silver metal legs bent out from its body like the limbs of a spider, the tiny feet seemingly trapped in silver puddles of frozen steel. With the tip of his finest soldering iron, Walker prodded a spot of silver while he worked the suction bulb with his foot. The metal around the chip's tiny foot melted and was pulled through a straw, one little leg of 16 free. He was about to move to the other, he had stayed up all night pulling fried chips to distract his mind from other things, when he heard the recognizable patter of that new porter skittering down his hall. Walker dropped the board and hot iron on the workbench and hurried to his door. He held the jam and leaned out as the kid ran past.
Porter!
He yelled, and the boy reluctantly stopped.
What news, boy?
The kid smiled, revealing the whites of youth.
I've got big news, he said. Cost you a chit, though.
Walker grunted with disgust, but dug into his coveralls. He waved the kid over.
Yeah, that's Samson boy, right?
The kid bobbed his head, his hair dancing around his youthful face.
Shattered under Gloria, didn't you?
The kid nodded again, as his eyes followed the silver chit drawn from Walker's rattling pockets.
You know, Gloria used to take pity on an old man with no family and no life. Trusted me with news, she did.
Gloria's dead,
the boy said, lifting his palm.
That she is, Walker said with a sigh.
He dropped the chit into the child's outstretched palm, and waved his aged and spotted own for the news. He was dying to know everything, and would have gladly paid 10 chits.
The details, child, don't skip a one.
No cleaning, Mr. Walker.
Walker's heart missed a beat. The boy turned his shoulder to run on.
Stay, boy, what do you mean, no cleaning? She's been set free?
The porter shook his head. His hair was long, wild, and seemingly built for flying up and down the staircase.
No, sir, she refused.
The child's eyes were electric, his grin huge with the possession of such knowledge. No one had ever refused to clean in his lifetime.
In Walker's, either. Maybe not ever.
Walker felt a surge of pride in his Juliet. The boy waited a moment. He seemed eager to run off.
Anything else?
Walker asked. Samson nodded and glanced at Walker's pockets. Walker let out a long sigh of disgust for what had become of this generation. He dug into his pocket with one hand and waved impatiently with the other.
She's gone, Mr. Walker.
He snatched the chit from Walker's palm.
Gone? As in dead? Speak up, son.
Samson's teeth flashed as the chit disappeared into his overalls.
No, sir, gone as in over the hill. No cleaning, Mr. Walker. Just strode right over and out of view. Gone to the city. And Mr. Bernard witnessed the whole thing.
The young porter slapped Walker on the arm, needing, obviously, to strike something with his enthusiasm. He swiped his hair off his face, smiled large, and turned to run along his route, his feet lighter and pockets heavier from the tail. Walker was left stunned in the doorway. He gripped the jam with an iron claw, lest he tumble out into the world. He stood there swaying, looking down at the pile of dishes he'd slipped outside the night before. He glanced over his shoulder at the disheveled cot that had been calling his name all night. Smoke still rose from the soldering iron. He turned away from the hall, which would soon be pattering and clinking with the sounds of first shift, and unplugged the iron before he started another fire. He remained there a moment, thinking about Jules, thinking about this news. He wondered if she'd gotten his note in time, if it had lessened the awful fear he'd felt in his gut for her. Walker returned to the doorway. The down deep was stirring. He felt a powerful tug to go out there, to cross that threshold, to be a part of the unprecedented. Shirley would probably be by soon with his breakfast and to take away his dishes. He could wait for her, maybe talk a bit. Perhaps this spell of insanity would pass. But the thought of waiting, of the minutes stacking up like work orders, of not knowing how far Juliet had gotten or what reactions the others might be having to her not cleaning, pressed him into motion. Walker lifted his foot and reached out past his doorway, his boot hovering over untrammeled ground. He took a deep breath, fell forward, and caught himself on it. And suddenly, he felt like an intrepid explorer himself. There he was, 40-something years later,
teetering down a familiar hallway, one hand brushing the steel walls, a corner coming up, around which his eyes could remember nothing. And Walker became one more old soul pushing into the great unknown, his brain dizzy with what he might find out there. 34. Is there no pity sitting in the clouds that sees into the bottom of my grief? O sweet my mother, cast me not away. The heavy steel doors of the silo parted, and a great cloud of argon billowed out with an angry hiss. The cloud seemed to materialize from nowhere, the compressed gas blossoming into a whipped froth as it met the warmer, less dense air beyond. Juliet Nichols stuck one boot through that narrow gap. The doors opened only part way to hold back the deadly toxins, to force the argon through with pent-up pressure, so she had to turn sideways to squeeze past, her bulky suit rubbing against the thick doors. All she could think of was the raging fire that would soon fill the airlock. Its flames seemed to lick at her back, forcing her to flee. She pulled her other boot through, and she suddenly found herself outside. Outside. There was nothing above her helmeted head but clouds, sky, and the unseen stars. She lumbered forward, emerging through the fog of hissing argon, to find herself on an upward-sloping ramp, the corners by the walls caked high with wind-trapped dirt. It was easy to forget that the top floor of the silo was below ground. The view from her old office and the cafeteria created an illusion of standing on the surface of the earth, head up in the wild air, but that was because the sensors were located there. Juliet looked down at the numbers on her chest and remembered what she was supposed to be doing. She trudged up the ramp, head down, focusing on her boots. She wasn't sure how she even moved, if it was the numbness one succumbed to in the face of execution, or if it was just automated self-preservation, simply a move away from the coming inferno in the airlock, her body delaying the inevitable because it couldn't think or plan beyond the next fistful of seconds. As Juliet reached the top of the ramp, her head emerged into a lie, a grand and gorgeous untruth. Green grass covered the hills like newly laid carpet. The skies were intoxicatingly blue, the clouds bleached white like fancy linen, the air peppered with soaring things. She spun in place and took in the spectacular fabrication. It was as if she'd been dropped into a book from her youth, a book where animals talked and children flew and gray was never found. Even knowing it wasn't real, knowing that she was looking through an 8x2-inch fib, the temptation to believe was overwhelming. She wanted to. She wanted to forget what she knew of IT's devious program, to forget everything she and Walker had discussed, and to fall instead to the soft grasses that weren't there, to roll around in the life that wasn't, to strip off the ridiculous suit and go screaming happily across the lying landscape. She looked down at her hands, clenched and unclenched them as much as the thick gloves would allow. This was her coffin. Her thoughts scattered as she fought to remember what was real and what was a false hope laid on top by IT and her visor. The sky was not real. The grass was not real. Her death was real. The ugly world she had always known was real. And then for just a moment, she remembered that she was supposed to be doing something. She was supposed to be cleaning. She turned and gazed at the sensor tower, seeing it for the first time. It was a sturdy block of steel and concrete, with a rusted and pitted ladder running up one side. The bulging sensor pods were stuck like warts on the faces of the tower. Juliet reached for her chest, grabbed one of the scrubbing pads, and tore it loose. The note from Walker continued to stream through her mind. No fear. She took the coarse wool pad and rubbed it against the arm of her suit. The heat tape wrapping did not peel, did not flake away like the stuff she'd once stolen from IT, the tape they'd engineered to fail. This was the brand of heat tape Juliet was used to working with, Mechanicals design. They're good in supply, Walker's note had said. The good had referred to the people of supply. After years of helping Juliet score spares when she needed them most, they had done something extraordinary for her. While she had spent 3 days climbing stairs and 3 lonely nights in 3 different holding cells on her way to banishment, they had replaced IT's materials with those from Mechanical. They'd fulfilled their orders for parts in a most devious way, and it must have been at Walker's behest. IT had then, unwittingly and for once, built a suit designed to last, not to disintegrate. Juliet smiled. Her death, however certain, was delayed. She took a long look at the sensors, relaxed her fingers, and dropped the wool pad into the fake grass. Turning for the nearest hill, she tried her best to ignore the false colors and the layers of life projected on top of what was truly there. Rather than give in to the euphoria, she concentrated on the way her boots clomped on the packed earth, noted the feel of the angry wind buffeting against her suit, listened for the faint hiss as grains of sand pelted her helmet from all sides. There was a terrifying world around her, one she could be dimly aware of if she concentrated hard enough, a world she knew but could no longer see. She started up the steep slope and headed vaguely toward the gleaming metropolis over the horizon. There was little thought of making it there. All she wanted was to die beyond the hills where no one would have to watch her rot away, so that Lucas the Star Hunter would not be afraid to come up at twilight for fear of seeing her still form. And suddenly, it felt good to simply be walking, to have some purpose. She would take herself out of sight. It was a more solid goal than that false city which she knew to be crumbling. Partway up the hill, she came to a pair of large rocks. Juliet started to dodge around them before she realized where she was, that she had followed the most gentle path up the crook of two colliding slopes. And here lay the most horrible lie of them all. Holston and Allison, hidden from her by the magic of the visor, covered by a mirage of stone. There were no words, nothing to see, nothing to say. She glanced down the hill and spotted other sporadic boulders resting in the grass, their position not random at all, but where cleaners of old had collapsed. She turned away, leaving these sad things behind. It was impossible to know how much time she had, how long to hide her body from those who might gloat, and the few who might mourn. Climbing toward the crest of the hill, her legs still sore from ascending the silo, Juliet witnessed the first rips in IT's deceitful veil. New portions of the sky and the distant city came into view, parts that had been obscured by the hill from down below. There seemed to be a break in the program, a limit to its lies. While the upper levels of the distant monoliths appeared whole and gleamed in the false sunlight, below these sharp panes of glass and bright steel lay the rotted dinginess of an abandoned world. She could see straight through the bottom levels of many of the buildings, and with their heavy tops projected onto them, they seemed liable to topple at any moment. To the side, the extra and unfamiliar buildings had no supports at all, no foundations. They hung in the air with dark sky beneath them. This same dark vista of gray clouds and lifeless hills stretched out across the low horizon, a hard line of painted blue where the visor's program met its end. Juliet puzzled over the incompleteness of IT's deceit. Was it because they themselves had no idea what lay beyond the hills, and so couldn't guess what to modify? Or did they deem it not worth the effort, knowing nobody would ever make it this far? Whatever the reason, the jarring and illogical nature of the view left her dizzy. She concentrated instead on her feet, taking those last dozen steps up the painted green hill until she reached the crest. At the top, she paused while heavy gusts of wind buffeted against her, causing her to lean into their turbulence. She scanned the horizon and saw that she stood on the divide between two worlds. Down the slope before her, on a landscape her eyes had never before seen, lay a bare world of dust and parched earth, of wind flurries and small tornadoes, of air that could kill. Here was new land, and yet it looked more familiar to her than anything she'd encountered thus far. She turned and peered back along the path she had just climbed, at the tall grasses blowing in the gentle breeze, at occasional flowers dipping their heads at her, at the bright blue and brilliant white overhead. It was an evil concoction, inviting but false. Juliet took one last admiring gaze at this illusion. She noted how the round depression in the center of the hills seemed to mark the outline of her silo's flat roof, the rest of her habitable home nestled deep in the belly of the soil. The way the land rose up all around made it look as though a hungry god had spooned out a large bite of the earth. With a heavy heart, she realized that the world she had grown up in was now closed off to her, that her home and her people were safe behind bolted doors, and she must be resigned to her fate. She had been cast off. Her time was short, and so she turned her back on the alluring view and bright colors to face the dusty, the dead, and the real. As she started down the hill, Juliet pulled cautiously on the air in her suit. She knew Walker had given her the gift of time, time no cleaner before her had ever had. But how much? And for what? She had already reached her goal, had managed to haul herself out of the censor's sight, so why was she still walking, still staggering down this foreign hill? Was it inertia? The pull of gravity? The sight of the unknown? She was barely down the slope, heading in the general direction of the crumbling city, when she stopped to survey the unfamiliar landscape before her. The elevation made it possible to choose a path for her final walk, this maiden walk, across the tall dunes of dry earth. And that's when she saw, gazing out toward the rusting city beyond, that the hollow in which her silo resided was no accident. The hills bore a clear pattern as they stretched into the distance. It was one circular bowl after another, the earth rising up between them as if to shield each spooned-out bite from the caustic wind. Juliet descended into the next bowl, pondering this, watching her footing as she went. She kicked aside the larger rocks and controlled her breathing. She knew from working deep in the flooded basins, swimming beneath the muck that burly men cringed from as she unclogged the drains, that air could be conserved through calmness. She glanced up, wondering if she had enough in the suit to cross this bowl and make it up the next great hill. And that's when she saw the slender tower rising from the center of the bowl, its exposed metal glinting in the sparse sunlight. The landscape here was untouched by the program in her visor. Reality passed through her helmet untarnished. And seeing this, the familiar sensor tower, she wondered if perhaps she'd gotten turned around, if she had surveyed the world one too many times from the crest of the hill, if she was, in fact, trudging back toward her silo, covering ground already crossed before. The sight of a dead cleaner wasting away in the dirt seemed to confirm this. It was a bare outline, ribbons of an old suit, the husk of a helmet. She stopped and touched the dome of the helmet with the toe of her boot, and the shell crumbled and caved in. Whatever flesh and bone had been inside had long ago drifted off on the winds. Juliet looked down the hill for the sleeping couple, but the crook of those two dunes was nowhere in sight. She suddenly felt bewildered and lost. She wondered if the air had finally worked past the seals and heat tape, if her brain was succumbing to noxious fumes. But no. She was nearer the city, still walking toward that skyline, the tops of which were still rendered whole and gleaming, the sky above them blue and spotted with bright clouds. It meant this tower below her was not hers, and these dunes, these great mounds of dead earth, were not meant to block out the winds or hold back the air. They were meant to shield curious eyes, to block this sight, this view of some other. 35. One, two, and the third in your bosom. Lucas held the small box tightly against his chest as he hiked up to the landing on 38. Here was a mixed-use level of offices, shops, a plastics factory, and one of the small water treatment plants. He pushed through the doors and hurried down corridors quiet from the day's cleaning until he reached the main pump control room. His IT master key allowed him inside. The room housed a tall and familiar computer cabinet from his Tuesday maintenance schedule. Lucas left the overhead light off to keep the small window in the door darkened to passers-by. He slid behind the tall server rack in the wall, scooted to the ground, and fished his flashlight out of his overalls. In the soft red glow of his nightlight, Lucas gently peeled the flaps of the box apart, revealing the contents inside. The guilt was immediate. It punctured the anticipation, the thrill of discovery, of intimacy. It wasn't guilt from defying his boss or lying to Deputy Marsh, nor of delaying the delivery of items he had been told were important. It was the violation of her things, the reminder of her fate. Here were Juliet's remains, not her body, which was lost and gone, but the remnants of the life she had lived. He took a heavy breath, considered closing the flaps and forgetting the contents, and then thought of what would become of them anyway. His friends in IT would probably be the ones to paw through them. They would tear open the box and trade items like kids swapping candy. They would desecrate her. He bent the flaps open further and decided to honor her instead. He adjusted his light and saw a stack of silo vouchers on top, wrapped in a piece of wire. He pulled these out and flipped through them. They were vacation vouchers, dozens of them. He lifted them to his nose and puzzled over the tangy scent of grease emanating from the box. A few expired meal cards lay underneath these vouchers, the corner of an ID badge poking out. Lucas reached for the badge, coded gold from her job as sheriff. He searched for another ID among the various scattered cards, but it appeared it had not yet been replaced with whatever color Mechanical used. There hadn't been that much time between her being fired for one offense and being put to death for another. He took a moment to study the picture on the badge. It looked recent, just as he remembered her. Her hair was tied back tight, leaving it flat on her head. He could see loose curls sticking out at either side of her neck, and remembered the first night he had watched her work, how she had braided her long hair herself while she sat alone in a pool of light, peering at page after page in those folders of hers. He ran his finger over the picture and laughed when he saw her expression. Her forehead was wrinkled, her eyes narrowed, as if trying to determine what the photographer was attempting or why in the heavens it was taking so long. He covered his mouth to prevent the laugh from becoming a sob. The vouchers went back into the box, but the ID slid into the breast pocket of his overalls as if by Juliet's own stubborn accord. The next thing that caught his eye was a silver multi-tool, new-looking, a slightly different model from his own. He grabbed this and leaned forward to pull his own tool out of his back pocket. He compared the two, opening a few of the tools on hers and admiring the smooth motion and neat click as each attachment locked into place. Taking a moment to first clean his, wiping his prints off and removing a bit of melted rubber wire casing, he switched the tools. He decided he would rather carry this reminder of her and have his own tool disappear into storage or be pawned off to a stranger who wouldn't appreciate. Lucas froze at the sound of footsteps and laughter. He held his breath and waited for someone to come in, for the overhead lights to burst on. The server clicked and whirred beside him. The noise in the hallway receded, the laughter fading. He was pushing his luck, he knew, but there was more in the box to see. He rummaged inside again and found an ornate wooden box, a valuable antique. It was just slightly bigger than his palm, and he took a moment to figure out how to open it. The first thing he saw as the top slid away was a ring, a woman's wedding ring. It could have been solid gold, but it was difficult to tell. The red glow from his flashlight tended to wash out colors, causing everything to appear dull and lifeless. He checked for an inscription, but found none. It was a curious artifact, this ring. He was certain Juliet hadn't been wearing it when he'd known her, and he wondered if it was a relative's, or a thing passed down from before the uprising. He placed it back in the wooden box and reached for the other item inside, a bracelet of some sort. No, not a bracelet. As he pulled it out, he saw that it was a watch, the face so tiny it melded with the design of the jeweled strap. Lucas studied the face, and after a moment he realized his eyes, or the red flashlight, were playing tricks on him. Or were they? He looked closely to be sure, and saw that one of the impossibly thin hands was ticking away the time. The thing worked. Before he could contemplate the challenge of concealing such an item or the consequences of being discovered with it, Lucas slid the watch into his chest pocket. He looked at the ring sitting alone in the box, and after a moment's hesitation, palmed this and stashed it away as well. He fished through the cardboard box and gathered some of the loose chits at the bottom and placed these into the antique box before sealing it shut and returning it. What was he doing? He could feel a trickle of sweat work its way from his scalp and run the length of his jawline. The heat from the rear of the busy computer seemed to intensify. He dipped his head and lifted his shoulder to dab the itchy run of sweat away. There was more in the box, and he couldn't help himself. He had to keep looking. He found a small notepad and flipped through it. It contained one to-do list after another, all of the items neatly crossed out. He replaced this and reached for a folded piece of paper at the bottom of the box, then realized it was more than a piece. He pulled out a thick collection of papers held together with brass fasteners. Across the top, in handwriting similar to that in the notebook, was printed, "Main Generator Control Room Operation Manual." He flipped it open and found inscrutable diagrams and bulleted notes lining the margins. It looked like something she'd put together herself, either as a reminder from piecing the room's operation together over time, or perhaps as a helpful guide for others. The paper was recycled without being pulped, he saw. She had just written on the back. He flipped the manual over and checked the lines and lines of printed text on the opposite side. There were notes in the margins, and a name circled over and over. Juliet. 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 He flipped the manual over and surveyed the rear, only to find it was the original front. "The Tragic History of Romeus and Juliet," it said. It was a play, one Lucas had heard of. In front of him, A fan kicked on in the heart of the server, blowing air over warm chips of silicon and wire. He wiped the sweat from his forehead and tucked the bound play back into the box. He neatly arranged the other items on top and folded the cardboard flaps together. Wiggling back to his feet, Lucas doused his light and shoved it back into his pocket, where it nestled against Juliet's multi-tool. With the box secured under one arm, he patted his chest with his other hand and felt her watch, her ring, and her ID there, with its picture of her, all tight against his torso. Lucas shook his head. He wondered what the hell he was thinking as he stole out of the small and dark room, a tall panel of winking and blinking lights watching him go.
36. Eyes look your last, arms take your last embrace, and lips, O you the doors of breath, seal with a righteous kiss a dateless bargain to engrossing death. The bodies were everywhere, covered in dust and dirt, suits worn down by the toxic eaters that lived in the winds. Juliet found herself stumbling over more and more of them. And then they were constant, a mass of boulders jumbled together. A few were in suits similar to her own, but most wore rags that had been eaten away into streamers. When the wind blew past her boots and across the bodies, strips of clothing waved like kelp in the down-deep's fish farms. Unable to pick her way around them all, she found herself stepping over the remains, working her way closer and closer to the sensor tower, the bodies easily in the hundreds, possibly the thousands. These weren't people from her silo, she realized. However obvious the sensation was startling. Other people. That they were dead did nothing to diminish the soul-shattering reality that people had lived so close and she had never known. Juliet had somehow crossed an uninhabitable void, had gone from one universe to another, was possibly the first ever to have done so. And here was a graveyard of foreign souls, a people just like her having lived and died in a world so similar and so near to her own. She made her way through dead bodies thick as crumbling rock, the forms becoming indistinguishable from one another. They were piled high in places, and she had to choose her path carefully. As she neared the ramp leading down to this other silo, she found herself needing to step on a body or two in order to pass. It looked as though they'd been trying to get away and had scampered over one another, creating their own small hills in a mad attempt to reach the real ones. But then, when she reached the ramp leading down, she saw the crush of bodies at the steel airlock door and realized they'd been trying to get back in. Her own imminent death loomed large, a constant awareness, a new sense worn on her skin and felt keenly in every pore. She would soon join these bodies, and somehow she was not afraid. She had passed through that fear on the crest of the hill and was now in new lands, seeing new things, a terrible gift for which she had to be grateful. Curiosity drove her forward, or maybe it was the mentality of this frozen crowd, all in scrambling repose, bodies swimming over each other and reaching toward the doors below. She swam among them, waded where she had to. She stepped through broken and hollow bodies, kicked aside bones and tattered remains, and fought her way to the partly cracked doors. There was a figure there frozen between its iron teeth, one arm in, one out, a scream trapped on a gray and withered face, two eye sockets empty and staring. Juliet was one of them, one of these others. She was dead, or nearly so. But while they were frozen in motion, she was still pushing ahead, shown the way. She tugged the body out of the gap, her breathing loud in her helmet, her exhalations misting on the screen before her nose. Half the body pulled free, the other half collapsed inside the door. A mist of powdered flesh drifted down in between. She wiggled one of her arms inside and tried to push through sideways. Her shoulder slipped through, then her leg, but her helmet caught. She turned her head and tried again, but the helmet still wedged tightly between the doors. There was a moment of panic as she could feel the steel jaws gripping her head, supporting the weight of her helmet, leaving her semi-dangling from its grasp. She swam her arm all the way through, trying to reach around the door for purchase, to pull herself the rest of the way, but her torso was stuck. One leg was in, the other out. There was nothing to push against or pull in order to go the rest of the way.
She was trapped, an arm useless on the inside, waving frantically, her rapid breathing using up what remained of her air. Juliet tried to fit her other arm through. She couldn't turn her waist, but she could bend her elbow and slide her fingers across her belly through the tight space between her stomach and the door. She curled her fingers around the edge of the steel and pulled. There was no leverage in those confines. It was just the strength in her fingers, in her grip. Juliet suddenly didn't want to die. Not there. She curled her hand as if to make a fist, her fingers bent around the edge of those steel jaws, her knuckles singing out from the strain. Jerking her head against her helmet, trying to bang her face against the damned screen, twisting and shoving and yanking, she suddenly popped free. She stumbled forward into the airlock, a boot catching briefly on the gap behind her, arms windmilling for balance as she kicked through a pile of charred bones and sent a cloud of black ash into the air. It was the remains of those who'd been caught in the cleansing fire of the airlock. Juliet found herself in a burned room eerily similar to the one she had recently left. Her exhausted and bewildered mind spun with outrageous delusions. Perhaps she was already dead, and these were the ghosts awaiting her. Maybe she had burned alive inside the airlock of her own silo, and these were her mad dreams, her escape from the pain, and now she would haunt this place forever. She stumbled through the scattered remains toward the inner door and pressed her head against the thick glass porthole. She looked for Peter Billings beyond, sitting at his desk, or perhaps a glimpse of Holston wandering the hallways, a specter searching for his ghostly wife. But this was not the same airlock. She tried to calm herself. She wondered if her air was running low, if sucking on her own exhaust was like breathing the fumes of a hot motor, choking off her brain. The door was sealed. It was real. The thousands were dead, but she wasn't. Not yet. She tried to spin the large wheel that secured the door, but it was either frozen in place or locked from the inside. Juliet banged on the glass, hoping the silo sheriff would hear her, or maybe a cafeteria worker. It was dark inside, but the thought lingered that someone must be there. People lived inside silos. They didn't belong piled up around them. There was no answer. No light flicked on. She leaned on the large wheel, remembered Marnes's instructions, how all the mechanisms worked. But those lessons felt like so long ago, and she hadn't thought them important at the time. But she remembered something. After the argon bath and the fire, didn't the inner door unlock, automatically, so the airlock could be scrubbed? This seemed like something she remembered Marnes saying. He had joked that it wasn't as if anyone could come back inside once the fire had run its course. Was she remembering this, or making it up? Was it the wishful thinking of an oxygen-starved mind? Either way, the wheel on the door wouldn't budge. Juliet pushed down with all her weight, but it definitely felt locked to her. She stepped back. The bench hanging from the wall where cleaners got suited up before their deaths looked inviting. She was tired from the walk, from the struggle to get inside. And why was she trying to get inside? She spun in place, indecisive. What was she doing? She needed air. For some reason, she thought the silo might have some. She looked around at all the scattered bones of an uncountable number of bodies. How many dead? They were too jumbled to know. The skulls, she thought. She could count those and know. She shook this nonsense from her head. She was definitely losing her senses. The wheel on the door is a stuck nut, some receding part of her said. It's a frozen bolt. And hadn't she made a reputation as a young shadow for working them free? Juliet told herself that this could be done. Grease, heat, leverage. Those were the secrets to a piece of metal that wouldn't budge. She didn't have any of the three, but she looked around anyway. There was no squeezing back through the outer door. She knew she wouldn't make it a second time, not that kind of straining. So she had this room. The bench was secured to the wall along the back edge and hung from two chains. Juliet wiggled the chains but didn't see how they could come free, or what good they would do her anyway. In the corner there was a pipe snaking up that led into a series of vents. It must be what delivered the argon, she thought. She wrapped her hands around the pipe, put her feet on the wall, and tugged. The connection to the vent wiggled. The toxic air had corroded and weakened it. Juliet smiled, set her teeth,
and yanked back ferociously. The pipe came free of the vent and bent at its base. She felt a sudden thrill, like a wild rat standing over a large crumb. She grabbed the free end of the pipe and worked it back and forth, bending and wrenching the fastened end. Metal would snap if you could wiggle it even a little bit, if you did it long enough. She had felt the heat of weakened steel countless times while bending it over and over until it broke. Sweat beaded on her brow and twinkled in the dim light allowed by her visor screen. It dripped down her nose, fogged the screen, and still she yanked and pushed, back and forth, growing frantic and desperate. The pipe snapped, taking her by surprise. Just a faint pop bled through her helmet, and then the long piece of hollow metal was free. One end was crushed and twisted, the other whole and round. Juliet turned to the door, a tool now in hand. She slid the pipe through the wheel, leaving as much as she could hanging out the side, just short enough not to brush the wall. With both gloved hands wrapped around the pipe, she hoisted herself and bent at the waist over the pipe, her helmet touching the door. She bounced her weight on the lever, knowing it was a jerking motion that freed a bolt, not a steady force. She wiggled her way toward the end of the pipe, watching it bend a little, worried it might snap in half long before the door budged. When she got toward the end, maximum leverage, she threw her weight up and down with all her strength, and she cursed as the pipe snapped. There was a loud clang, barely muffled by her suit, and then she collapsed to the floor, landing painfully on her elbow. The pipe was at an angle beneath her, digging into her ribs. Juliet tried to catch her breath. Her sweat dripped against the visor screen, blurring her view. She got up and saw that the pipe was unbroken. She wondered if it had slipped free, but it was still threaded through the spokes of the large wheel. Disbelieving, excited, she slid the pipe out the other side. She wrapped her hands around the spokes and leaned into it. And the wheel. It budged. 37. For now, these hot days, is the mad blood stirring. Walker made it to the end of the hallway and found himself leaving the comforting confines of a tight corridor to enter the wider entrance hall to mechanical. The room, he saw, was full of young shadows. They hung out in groups, whispering to themselves. Three boys crouched near one wall, throwing stones for chits. Walker could hear a dozen interwoven voices spilling out of the mess hall across the room. The casters had sent these young ears away while they discussed adult things. He took a deep breath and hurried through that damned open space, focusing on each step, moving one foot ahead of him at a time, each small patch of floor a thing to conquer. After a short lifetime, he finally crashed into the wall on the other side and hugged the steel panels in relief. Behind him, the shadows laughed, but he was too frightened to care. Sliding across the riveted steel, he grabbed the edge of the mess hall door and pulled himself inside. The relief was enormous. Even though the mess hall was several times the size of his workshop, it was at least full of crowding furniture and people he knew. With his back to the wall, his shoulder against the open door, he could almost pretend it was smaller. He slumped to the ground and rested, the men and women of mechanical arguing among themselves, voices rising, agitated, competing.
"She'd be out of air by now anyway," Rix was saying.
"You don't know that," Shirley said.
She was standing on a chair so she could be at least as tall as the others. She surveyed the room.
"We don't know what advances they've made. That's because they won't tell us. Maybe it's gotten better out there."
A room quieted with this last, waiting perhaps to see if the voice would dare speak again and break its anonymity. Walker studied the eyes of those facing his way. They were wide with a mixture of fear and excitement. A double cleaning had removed some taboos. Shadows had been sent away. The adults were feeling frisky and free to speak forbidden thoughts.
"What if it has gotten better?"
someone else asked.
"Since 2 weeks ago? I'm telling you guys, it's the suits. They figured out the suits."
Mark, an oil man, looked around at the others, anger in his eyes.
"I'm sure of it," he said. "They've sorted the suits, and now we have a chance."
"A chance to what?"
Knox growled. The grizzled head of mechanical sat at one of the tables, digging into a breakfast bowl.
"A chance to send more of our people out to wander the hills until they run out of air?"
He shook his head and took another bite, then jabbed at the lot of them with his spoon.
"What we need to be talking about,"
he said, chewing.
is this sham of an election, this rat-ass mayor, and us kept in the dark down here.
They didn't figure out the suits, Walker hissed, still breathless from his ordeal.
We're the ones who keep this place humming,
Knox continued, wiping his beard.
And what do we get? Busted fingers and rat shit pay. And now? Now they come and take our people and send them out for a view we don't care about.
He slammed the table with his mighty fist, sending his bowl hopping. Walker cleared his throat. He remained crouched on the floor, his back against the wall. No one had seen him enter or heard him the first time. Now, while the room was scared quiet by Knox, he tried again.
They did not figure out the suits, he said, a little louder this time.
Shirley saw him from her perch, her chin dropped, her mouth hanging open. She pointed, and a dozen other heads turned to follow. They gaped at him. Walker was still trying to catch his breath and must have looked near death. Courtney, one of the young plumbers who was always kind to him whenever she stopped by his workshop, left her seat and hurried to his side. She whispered his name in surprise and helped him to his feet, urging him to come to the table and take her chair. Knox slid his bowl away from himself and slapped the table.
Well, people are just wandering all over the damn place now, aren't they?
Walker looked up sheepishly to see the old foreman chief smiling through his beard at him. There were 24 other people staring at him all at once. Walker half-waved, then stared down at the table. It was suddenly too many people.
All this shouting rouse you, old man? You setting off over the hills, too?
Shirley jumped down from her chair. Oh, God, I'm so sorry. I forgot to take him his breakfast. She hurried toward the kitchen to fetch him some food, even as Walker tried to wave her off. He wasn't hungry.
It isn't.
His voice cracked. He tried again.
I came because I heard, he whispered. Jules. Out of sight.
He made a gesture with his hand, arching it over some imaginary hill running across the table.
But it wasn't them in IT that figured nothing, he said.
He made eye contact with Mark and tapped his own chest.
I did it.
A whispered conversation in the corner fell quiet. No one sipped their juice. No one moved. They were still half stunned to see Walker out of his workshop, much less among the crowd of them. Not one of them had been old enough to remember the last time he'd roamed about. They knew him as the crazy electrical man who lived in a cave and refused to cast shadows anymore.
What are you saying?
Knox asked. Walker took a deep breath. He was about to speak when Shirley returned and placed a bowl of hot oats in front of him, the spoon standing off the rim. The concoction was so thick, just how he liked it. He pressed his hands against either side of the bowl, feeling the heat in his palms. He was suddenly very tired from lack of sleep. Walk? Shirley asked. You okay? He nodded and waved her away, lifted his head and met Knox's gaze.
Jules came to me the other day.
He bobbed his head, gaining confidence. He tried to ignore how many people were watching him speak and the way the overhead lights twinkled in his watering eyes.
She had a theory about these suits, about IT.
With one hand, he stirred his oats, stealing his resolve to say the unthinkable. But then, how old was he? Why did he care for taboos?
You remember the heat tape?
He turned to Rochelle, who worked first shift and knew Juliet well. She nodded.
Jules sorted that it weren't no accident, the way the tape broke down.
He nodded to himself.
She sorted it all, she did.
He took a bite of his food, not hungry but enjoying the burn of the hot spoon on his tongue. The room was silent, waiting. The whispers and quiet play of the shadows outside could just barely be heard.
I've built up favors and favors with supply over the years,
he explained.
Favors and favors. So I called them all in. Told them we'd be even.
He looked at this group of men and women from Mechanical, could hear more standing in the hallway who'd arrived late, but could read from the frozen demeanors in the room to stay put.
We've taken stuff out of IT's supply chain before. I know I have. All the best electronics and wire go to them that make the suits.
The ratchet bastards,
someone muttered, which got more than a few of them bobbing their heads.
So I told Supply to return the favor, soon as I heard they took her.
Walker paused and swiped at his eyes.
Soon as I heard, I wired in those favors, said to replace anything them bastard asked for with some of our own. Best of the best, and don't let them be the wiser.
You did what?
Knox asked. Walker dipped his head over and over. It felt good to let out the truth,
They've been making those suits to fail. Not because it ain't bad out there. That's not what I figure. But they don't want your body wandering out of sight, no sir.
He stirred his oats.
They want us all right here where they can see us.
So she's okay? Shirley asked.
Walker frowned and slowly shook his head. I told you guys, someone said. She'd have run out of air by now.
She was dead anyway,
someone else countered, and the argument began to build again.
This just proves they're full of shit.
Walker had to agree with that.
Everybody, let's stay calm,
Knox roared. But he appeared the least calm of them all. More workers filed in now that the moment of silence appeared to be over. They gathered around the table, faces full of worry.
This is it,
Walker said to himself, seeing what was happening, what he had started. He watched his friends and co-workers get all riled up, barking at the empty air for answers, their passions stirred.
This is it,
he said again, and he could feel it brewing, ready to burst out.
This is it, this is it.
Courtney, still hovering over him, tending to him like he was an invalid, held his wrist with those delicate hands of hers.
What is it?
She asked. She waved down the others so she could hear. She leaned close to Walker.
Walk, tell me. What is it? What is this? What are you trying to say?
This is how it starts,
he whispered. A room quiet once more. He looked up at all the faces, scanned them, seeing in their fury, in all the exploded taboos, that he was right to worry.
This is how the uprising begins.
38. Sharp misery had worn him to the bones, and about his shelves a beggarly account of empty boxes. Lucas arrived at 34, breathless and clutching the small box, more exhausted from the laws he had broken than this habitual climb to work. He could still taste the metallic tang of adrenaline in his mouth from hiding behind the servers and rummaging through Juliet's things. He patted his chest, feeling the items there, and also his racing heart. Once he was better composed, he reached for the doors to IT and nearly cracked a knuckle as they flew outward toward him. Sammy, a tech he knew, burst out in a hurry and stormed past. Lucas called his name, but the older tech was already gone, storming up the stairs and out of sight. There was more commotion in the entrance hall, voices yelling over one another. Lucas entered warily, wondering what the fuss was about. He held open the door with his elbow and slid into the room, the box tight against his chest. Most of the yelling, it seemed, was coming from Bernard. The head of IT stood outside the security gates and was barking at one tech after the other. Nearby, Sims, the head of IT security, similarly laid into three men in gray overalls. Lucas remained frozen by the door, intimidated by the angry duo. When Bernard spotted him there, he snapped his mouth shut and waded through the trembling techs to greet him. Lucas opened his mouth to say something, but his boss was fixated less on him and more on what was in his hands.
This is it? Bernard asked, snatching the box from him. It? Everything that Greaser owned fits in this little damn box?
Bernard tugged the flaps open.
Is this everything?
That's what I was given, Lucas stammered.
Marsh said, yeah, the deputy wired about his cramps. I swear the pact should stipulate an age limit for their kind. Sams?
Bernard turned to his security chief.
Conference room, now.
Lucas pointed toward the security gate in the server room beyond.
I suppose I should get to-
Come with me,
Bernard said, wrapping his arm around Lucas's back and squeezing his shoulder.
I want you in on this. There seem to be fewer and fewer ratchet techs I can trust around here.
Unless you want me on the servers. We had that thing with Tower 13.
That can wait. This is more important.
Bernard ushered him toward the conference room, the hulking mass of Sims preceding them. The security guard grabbed the door and held it open, frowning at Lucas as he went by. Lucas shivered as he crossed the threshold. He could feel the sweat running down his chest, could feel guilty heat in his armpits and around his neck. He had a sudden image of being thrown against the table, pinned down, contraband yanked from his pockets and waved in his face.
Sit,
Bernard said. He put the box down on the table, and he and Sims began emptying its contents while Lucas lowered himself into a chair.
Vacation chits,
Sims said, pulling out the stack of paper coupons. Lucas watched the way the man's arms rippled with muscle with even the slightest movement. Sims had been a tech once, until his body kept growing and made him too obviously suited for other, less cerebral endeavors. He lifted the chits to his nose, took a sniff, and recoiled.
"Smells like sweaty greaser," he said.
"Counterfeit?"
Bernard asked. Sims shook his head. Bernard was inspecting the small wooden box. He shook it and rapped it with his knuckles, listening to the rattle of chits inside. He searched the exterior for a hinge or clasp. Lucas almost blurted out that the top slit, that it was so finely crafted you could barely see the joints, and that it took a bit of effort. Bernard muttered something and set the box aside.
"What exactly are we looking for?" Lucas asked.
He leaned forward and grabbed the box, pretended to be inspecting it for the first time.
"Anything, a fucking clue," Bernard barked.
He glared at Lucas.
"How did this greaser make it over the hill? Was it something she did? One of my techs? What?"
Lucas still couldn't figure out the anger. So what if she hadn't cleaned? It would have been a double anyway. Was Bernard furious because he didn't know why she'd survived so long? This made sense to Lucas. Whenever he fixed something by accident, it drove him nearly as nuts as having something break. He'd seen Bernard angry before, but this was something different. The man was livid. He was manic. It was just how Lucas would feel if he'd had such an unprecedented piece of success with no cause to pin it on. Sims, meanwhile, found the notebook and began flipping through it.
"Hey, boss."
Bernard snatched it from him and tore through the pages, reading.
"Someone'll have to go through all this," he said.
He pushed his glasses up his nose.
"There might be some sign of collusion in here."
"Hey, look," Lucas said, holding out the box. "It opens." He showed them the sliding lid.
"Let me see that."
Bernard dropped the notebook to the table and snatched the wooden box away. He wrinkled his nose.
"Just chits," he said disgustedly.
He dumped them on the table and was about to toss the box aside, but Sims grabbed it from him.
"That's an antique," the large man said. "You think it's a clue, or can I—"
"Yes, keep it by all means."
Bernard waved his arms out toward the window with its view of the entrance hall.
"Because nothing of greater fucking importance is going on around here, is it? Shit for brains."
Sims shrugged noncommittally and slid the wooden box into his pocket. Lucas desperately wanted to be somewhere else, anywhere in the silo but there.
"Maybe she just got lucky," Sims offered.
Bernard began dumping the rest of the box onto the table, shaking it to loosen the manual that Lucas knew was tightly wedged in the bottom. He paused in his efforts and squinted at Sims over the rims of his glasses.
"Lucky," Bernard repeated.
Sims tilted his head.
"Get the fuck out of here,"
Bernard told him. Sims nodded.
"Yeah, you're right."
"No, I mean get out!"
Bernard pointed at the door.
"Get the fuck out!"
The head of security smiled like this was funny, but lumbered for the door. He slid out of the room and gently clicked the door shut behind him.
"I'm surrounded by morons," Bernard said once they were alone.
Lucas tried to imagine this was not meant as an insult directed at him.
"Present company excluded,"
Bernard added, as if reading his mind.
"Thanks."
"Hey, you at least can fix a goddamn server. What the hell do I pay these other ratchet techs to do?"
He pressed his glasses up the bridge of his nose again, and Lucas tried to remember if the IT head had always cursed this much. He didn't think so. Was it the strain of being interim mayor that was getting to him? Something had changed. It felt strange to even consider Bernard his friend anymore. The man was so much more important now, so much busier. Perhaps he was cracking under the stress that came with the extra responsibility, the pain of being the one to send good people to cleaning.
"You know why I've never taken a shadow?"
Bernard asked. He flipped through the manual, saw the play on the reverse side, and turned the bound sheets of paper around. He glanced up at Lucas, who lifted his palms and shrugged.
"It's because I shudder to think of anyone else ever running this place."
Lucas assumed he meant IT, not the silo. Bernard hadn't been mayor very long. Bernard set the play down and gazed out the window, where muffled voices argued once more.
"But I'll have to one of these days. I'm at that age where your friends, the people you grew up with, are dropping like flies. But you're still young enough to pretend it won't happen to you."
His eyes fell to Lucas. The young tech felt uncomfortable being alone with Bernard. He'd never felt that before.
"Silos have burned to the ground before because of one man's hubris," Bernard told him. All it takes is improper planning, thinking you'll be around forever. But because one man disappears, he snapped his fingers, and leaves a sucking void behind, that can be enough to bring it all down.
Lucas was dying to ask his boss what the hell he was talking about.
Today is that day, I think.
Bernard walked around the long conference table, leaving behind him the scattered remnants of Juliet's life. Lucas's gaze drifted over the items. The guilt of going through them himself vanished when he saw how they'd been treated by Bernard. He wished instead that he'd stashed away more of them.
What I need is someone who already has access to the servers, Bernard said.
Lucas turned to the side and realized the short, full-bellied head of IT was standing right beside him. He moved his hands up to his chest pocket, making sure it didn't bulge open where Bernard could see.
Sammy's a good tech. I trust him, but he's nearly as old as I am.
You aren't that old, Lucas said, trying to be polite, to gather his wits. He wasn't sure what was going on.
There aren't many I consider friends, Bernard said.
I appreciate that.
You're probably the closest thing.
I feel the same.
I knew your father. He was a good man.
Lucas swallowed and nodded. He looked up at Bernard and realized the man was holding out his hand. Had been for a while. He extended his own to accept, still not sure what was being offered.
I need a shadow, Lucas.
Bernard's hand felt small in Lucas's own. He watched as his arm was pumped up and down.
I want you to be that man.
39. Wisely and slow, they stumble that run fast. Juliet forced her way through the inner airlock door and scrambled to get it closed. Darkness overwhelmed her as the heavy door squealed on its hinges and settled against its dry seals. She groped for the large locking wheel and leaned on the spokes, spinning it and sealing the door tight. The air in her suit was growing stale. She could feel the dizziness overtaking her. Turning around, keeping one hand on the wall, she stumbled forward through the darkness. The puff of outside air that she'd allowed inside seemed to claw at her back like a horde of mad insects. Juliet staggered blindly down the hallway, trying to put distance between herself and the dead she'd left behind. There were no lights on, no glow from the wall screens with their view of the outside world. She prayed the layout was the same, that she could find her way. She prayed the air in her suit would hold out a moment longer. Prayed the air in the silo wouldn't be as foul and toxic as the wind outside, or, and just as bad, that the air in the silo wouldn't be as devoid of oxygen as what little remained in her suit. Her hand brushed the bars of a cell just where they should have been, giving her hope that she could navigate the darkness. She wasn't sure what she hoped to find in the pitch black. She had no plan for salvation. She was simply stumbling away from the horrors outside. It hardly registered for her that she had been there, had gone outside, and was now in some place new. As she fumbled through the office, sucking on the last breaths of air in her helmet, her feet knocked into something, and Juliet went sprawling forward. She landed roughly on a soft mound, groped with her hand, and felt an arm. A body. Several bodies. Juliet crawled over them, the spongy flesh feeling more human and solid than the husks and bones outside, and more difficult to move across. She felt someone's chin. The weight of her body caused their neck to turn, and she nearly lost her balance. Her body recoiled at the sensation of what she was doing, the reflex to apologize, to pull her limbs away. But she forced herself forward over a pile of them, through the darkness, until her helmet slammed into the office door. Without warning, the blow was hard enough that Juliet saw stars and feared blacking out. She reached up and fumbled for the handle. Her eyes might as well have been sealed shut. The utter darkness was so complete. Even the bowels of mechanical had never seen such deep and perfect shadow. She found the latch and pushed. The door was unlocked but wouldn't budge. Juliet scrambled to her feet, her boots digging into lifeless bodies, and threw her shoulder against the door. She wanted out. The door moved, a little. She could feel something slide on the other side and imagined more bodies piled up. She threw herself again and again into the door, grunts of effort and frustrated tiny screams echoing in her helmet. Her hair was loose, sweaty, and matting to her face. She couldn't see, couldn't breathe, was growing more faint as she poisoned her own internal atmosphere. When the door slid open a crack, she tried to force her way through, one shoulder first, squeezing her helmet past, then pulling her other arm and leg after. She fell to the floor, scrambled around, and shoved herself against the door, sealing it.